Good afternoon. My name is Joseph Coleman, registration number 6856. I want to thank the Court of Appeals. Whoever consulted on the new building did a phenomenal job, and I appreciate coming in here instead of the Denver Post building.
So do we.
I thought you might. This case, in a way, is not particularly complex. It's a construction of language. The language is, you know, not extensive. But the question is it clear? The district court in some places said it's clear, no ambiguities. Other places she seems to imply that yes, there is some need to construe the document. And I agree with her. It was necessary. We have a term restricted to long-term rentals. Obviously, in and of itself, that term could have a lot of different meanings. We then presented some evidence, the most dispositive evidence being, what did the drafter mean? And so that you're not just getting a self-serving analysis from the drafter, did the town have the same understanding? So we have to put ourselves back into 1985. In 1985, and one thing I want to clarify, there was an earlier application in 1984 that related to what I'm going to call an 8-unit project that died on the vine, never made it to the town council. So when I'm referring to 1985, we're talking about three different buildings, each with 2 units in them.
Mr. Coleman, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Since you're going back to 1985, and I assume we're going to talk about some of the progression of this up to the point where the PUD was approved, we would then be looking at matters outside the language of the PUD document itself. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And in order to do so, is it not correct that we would have to first determine that the language in question is ambiguous?
Yes, I believe you need to make that preliminary analysis, not definitively. I think that you should allow in provisionally some information. And if with that information you decide, no, it was not ambiguous, then you would disregard it. So that, I think, is the only clarification. But yes, you would have to determine whether the term long-term rental is ambiguous. And so my question then becomes, some hotels will rent by the hour. Therefore, to them, long-term is a night. Other hotels will rent by the week. Obviously, a day would be short-term. A week might be considered long-term. The other extreme is there are long-term leases that are recognized in financial situations. They're 99-year leases, or at least over 30 years. So consequently, the term long is like most adjectives in the mind of the beholder. So in 1985, the parties attempted to put some additional information. They cited into a specific town code provision, ordinance provision. When I first saw the case, I said, oh, this will be easy. Long term, yes, that's subject to debate. But they're telling me exactly where to look so I can answer that. And if I look there and it said long term means more than a day or more than a month or more than a year, that would answer the question. But what's unique is that the ordinance that was cited didn't use the term long term, didn't give any parameters of what was meant by long term. What it was a provision that said short term accommodations are 30 days or less. So there's some question. You could say, well, that answers it. But the reality is, it didn't mention long-term. So the next logical question would be to ask the town, what did you mean by referencing short-term accommodations? And ask the drafter, what did you mean? The good part about this case is both of them answered the question the same. They didn't have self-serving, you know, 20 years later, revised recollections. They both answered that in Telluride, local usage was if you did not want short-term accommodations. The way you said that was long-term rentals. Now, why would they do that? Again, the evidence is undisputed that the concern at the time was, this is a residential area. And the town manager used the term, the hot button for the community was, short-term accommodations don't mix in residential areas. Simple reason, people who come for a week vacation, that's their time to stay up late, enjoy life, party, come in at all hours of the night. People who live long-term, sure, they go out late, they party, but they don't do it every day. They're not condensing their partying and their relaxation into 1 week. They spread it out over a year. So long-term accommodations had the importance of calming the neighborhood, preserving the single-family residency nature. That was the goal. And that's what's been so convoluted in this case. The town is arguing the one thing we wanted to preserve in 1985, the residential nature. 20 years later, we're going to take a different position and say, we don't want single family occupancy, which is the ideal. So what's unique about this case is when the parties both can agree to the definition, isn't it logical that if you agree upon a definition, you can take the original words out and put in the agreed upon defined words, and you get the true meaning?
Mr. Coleman, yes. What significance do you give to the language at the in the trial court hearing that's quoted on page 27 of the answer brief, where apparently Mr. Coward said that, or acknowledged that one of the reasons for this provision was because the people in Telluride needed or wanted long-term rentals.
Okay, the significance of that is we're now talking the number of units as opposed to usage. The number of units in Telluride is a growing community. They always are concerned about having enough beds, either for the tourists or for the, we'll call the workers. And absent this approval, there was an existing two houses. Under the existing code, there was a chance to double it, so there was potentially four. Under this, they ended up with six. So whether or not I'm using it as an employee who going to rent for 45 days, or an owner's using it and is going to stay there potentially for a year before he relets it, there's an additional bed available. So by approving this, Mr. Coward acknowledged, he said, if you approve this, we will increase the number of beds available for people. And we don't deny that. That was one of the purposes.
So if I understand your position correctly, the real difference is whether or not five or six units would be available for long-term rentals in the event that the Cowards decide to live in one of the units.
That is correct. There will always be more units available. And the nicety of a duplex is you have strongly encouraged an owner to, in effect, share his house. If it's a single family, yes, you can rent to somebody, you can rent a room, but it's not near as convenient nor as likely to be conducive to long-term rentals. So everyone understood that if this were allowed, Mr. Coward was increasing the number of beds available for the employee base of that town. And that will continue regardless of the decision of this court. There will always be six instead of a lesser number. But the question is, if you can take a definition and replace it with the original words, the town manager would be now reading this saying, if I insert my understanding, the covenant would say, no short-term accommodations, because those are the exact words that he intended when he signed off on restricted to long-term rentals. Nothing more, nothing less.
But it seems that you are arguing that the term long-term rental does not exclude residential, owner-occupied residential use of the property.
That is correct.
And how do you get by the term of the PUD or the PUD language that says that you shall be restricted to long-term rental?
I do it because in Telluride, the local usage of the words restricted to long-term rental means, according to the town manager, there shall not be short-term accommodations. So read that covenant that you just mentioned with the words in it that the town manager says we intended. Then the covenant reads, we approve 2 units per building and the various other things in there, and it gets down and it says, and we prohibit short-term accommodations. That's all that was meant. And it's 20 years later that someone's trying to add a new restriction. At this point, I would reserve my approximate 4 minutes, and I thank you for your attention.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Kevin J. Geiger, town attorney for the town of Telluride, attorney registration number 31339. Following a district court ruling in favor of the town of Telluride on this case, plaintiffs now appeal to the Court of Appeals on essentially two remaining issues. One, whether each unit in the Colorado Place PUD is indeed, quote, restricted to long-term rental, as stated on the Colorado Place PUD plat. And second, whether the owners of those units are precluded from occupying those units in the face of a clear requirement on the plat that these units are restricted to long-term rental.
Mr. Geiger, could the Cowarts form a sub-S corporation and rent that unit to the sub-S corporation for 6 months at $1 a month?
Your Honor, in this case, we clearly know that there have to be two units in each structure. So if they were to form an LLC and then try to rent to a sub-LLC, let's say, personally, I think that flies in the face of the intent of the language that was used on the plat and the intentions of the parties in 1985.
Well, where does it say in the restrictions that is impossible?
Your Honor, it does not say that is impossible. In fact, the district court also did find that the town did not clearly provide parameters on who could not occupy those units. That is correct.
Well, assume for just a moment that the Cowarts decided to do that. Does that seem absurd to you? That on the one hand, they could rent their property to a subchapter S corporation or an LLC or any other entity that they decided to form, but they couldn't rent it to themselves? I'm struggling for a legal reason for that distinction.
Your Honor, I think you bring up an appropriate point here, which is that by use of a legal fiction or a legal entity, there may be a way for them to occupy one unit in this duplex.
Okay.
But it does still...
And assume that that's so for just a moment. Didn't the trial court here consider information that was outside the four corners of the PUD?
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court did take into account evidence that was beyond the four corners. However, under the Telluride case, the Telluride number 2 case, we know that in interpreting real contracts, real property contracts or other contracts, we know that you can now look outside the strict four corners of a document to look at whether additional information indeed confirms the intent of a party in entering into that agreement, or also whether a contract on its face is ambiguous, bringing in extrinsic evidence to determine if there's an ambiguity in the contract.
Does the land use code of Telluride contain any prohibition of owner occupation? Express prohibition of owner occupation?
No, the Telluride land use code does not. However, we are under a specific restriction here imposed by a planned unit development, which is, as you know, under the Bixby case, a rezoning of the property. And under Bixby, we know that once the property is rezoned through a PUD process, only those uses that are prescribed in the approved PUD plan are permitted uses of the property. In this case, restricted to long-term rental is that prescribed use. It's the only use that's permitted on the property. In return, the town doubled the density on this property back in 1985.
Mr. Geiger, one thing that is not clear to me from having read the briefs is why the town is taking the position that it does, because if the Cowards were able to live in one of the units, then it would make the neighborhood, which is, or as I understand it, already residential, a little bit more residential. So is there some reason that's not immediately apparent as to why Telluride is taking the position that it is?
Yes, Your Honor. The approval that occurred in 1985 was basically the precursor to the town implementing affordable housing regulations throughout the town. We did not have previously at that point in time affordable housing regulations, but through this PUD process, the plaintiffs agreed if they would receive double the density, that they would commit to having these units restricted to long-term rental. And that was a benefit to the larger community so that those employees who were living here could find housing, even if it wasn't a prescribed housing in terms of how much income they make, whether they're a resident of the area, but it did require that it be long-term rented.
So going back to the question I asked Mr. Coleman, then, and based upon what you just said, this would, from the town standpoint, as a way of providing affordable housing to workers in Telluride, is that correct?
I think that is, and I would also at this point in time like to draw your attention to the expressions of the intent of plaintiffs on this. And we have Exhibit 4 in the record, which was a letter that Mr. Coward authored to the Planning and Zoning Commission in December of 1984. I know there's been some discussion in the supplemental authority that was filed as to whether statements, extrinsic statements by a drafter can be considered. I would point out that the KN Energy case that's been cited in the supplemental authority was about an oral expression of intent. And here we have a written expression of intent in that December letter. And there are a number of quotes that I think are interesting. The most appropriate one is the one that I think the court cited just recently, when Mr. Cowart was urging, in fact, maybe even pleading Planning and Zoning Commission to approve this doubling of density. He said, in short, the people of Telluride need long-term rentals. The people of Telluride know that we need long-term rentals, and the people of Telluride will continue to need long-term rentals. You have the ability tonight to answer some of that need. So here we have Mr. Cowart on the record stating his intent. He's saying, if you double the density for me, I will give you this restriction that these units will be long-term rented. You're not hearing language in there about, I will not short-term rent this. In fact, that letter that he authored used the phrase long-term rental or long-term rent 20 times. There's no mention in there of short-term rental and the restriction that I will not short-term rent these units.
So do you agree with my characterization to Mr. Coleman that the dispute between the parties now concerns whether 5 or 6 units would be available for a long-term or must be restricted to long-term rental?
I think all 6 units need to be available for long-term rental.
I understand that's your position, and as I understand it, the Cowards' position is that 5 of them should be available for long-term rental and that they believe they should be able to occupy one of the units as owner-occupied.
Your Honor, my response on that is, how do you have owner occupancy in the face of a clear restriction that says must be restricted to long-term rental?
Well, that's a different issue. I'm just asking if you agree with my characterization that the difference between the parties is whether 5 units or 6 units are available or must be used for long-term rental.
I think that's one issue that the court may have before it. I think there are a number of other issues as well, including the interpretation of what is a long-term rental, and then also the assertion that's now raised by the plaintiffs that all they meant to really do was not short-term rent this, which really turns the prohibition or the restriction on its face and says, I have all these other uses I can do, but I just can't short-term rent, where we view it as a restriction that they must be rented long-term.
Mr. Geiger, doesn't it make some sense to allow an owner to be on the premises as a landlord who's there and able to answer to tenants' requests and demands immediately, as opposed to having the landlord live in some other place?
Certainly, that could be a policy consideration. I believe that there was evidence in this case that the plaintiffs actually have an in-town representative that serves that function because they live out of state. So I don't know that we're seeing that as an appropriate consideration here, but it's something that could be a policy consideration, certainly.
And in fact, it'd save them some money, wouldn't it?
It depends whether they value their time and living in Telluride or living in another place that they would like to live in. I guess it's an individual determination, Your Honor.
Mr. Geiger, let me ask you this. You talk about the express language of the PUD covenant being restricted to long-term rental. Is that phrase or that language capable of more than one meaning? In other words, is it ambiguous or not?
I believe it is not subject to more than one reasonable interpretation. I know that that's the standard that's used when you're determining whether there's ambiguity in a restrictive covenant. I believe, given the circumstances that we have here, and the district court found that it was not subject to more than one reasonable interpretation. Of course, we know we're on a de novo review here, and that's your determination at this point in time. But the district court found that the testimony of Mr. Coward, as well as the town manager, was for duration, not in terms of the use, but for duration. Long-term was anything greater than short-term. And I would also point out, we know that there's a distinction under Colorado law, sales tax provisions that say long-term is 30 days or more, and short-term is less than 30 days, therefore it's taxed by the state of Colorado and by local jurisdictions. There is a distinction there, currently recognized, I think, in a whole range of canons of construction, where you can discern an intent, common usage, of long-term versus short-term accommodations.
But doesn't each side in this controversy agree that long-term means more than 30 days?
I hope so. I believe that is the case.
Seems like that they've agreed to that. However, would it be reasonable to interpret restricted to long-term rental as meaning if you rent the property, it has to be long-term? If there is any rental, it has to be long-term.
I don't believe so, given the use of the word restricted to. Restricted to means whatever follows that is the permitted use on the property, and you don't have the other range of uses that you might have under your underlying zoning. So again, restricted to long-term rental means that the use on the property, the use restriction here, the covenant in place, has to be long-term rental. We also know if there's any doubt as to the applicability of the covenants, the real covenant, the restrictive covenants here, Your Honor, we know we also have a PUD overlay here, a zoning overlay. I mentioned this before. We know that once the PUD is approved, it sets out the prescribed uses of the property. And that, again, prescribed use of the property, I should say, Your Honor, is restricted to long-term rental.
Mr. Geiger, are you aware of any other circumstance, either by statute or case law, that would prohibit an owner from living in his or her property?
I'm not aware of any statutory provisions on that, Your Honor, but I am aware of a number of other examples in Telluride where that is appropriate and deemed the restriction. And we reference those through the testimony of Greg Clifton, the town manager, where you have, again, affordable housing requirements that are being satisfied. If you have an owner of an affordable housing complex that has to dedicate that property to satisfy a mitigation requirement for affordable housing, that owner can't at the same time occupy that unit. It's reserved through the zoning process to be provided for and mitigate affordable housing requirements.
Well, let me just ask you a quick question about that, because you mentioned the concept of affordable housing several times, and that may be a laudable goal for the town, but as I understand it, the PUD here doesn't say anything about affordable housing. It just talks about rental.
That is correct, Your Honor. Again, this, we believe, was the precursor to the town's affordable housing ordinance. We were recognizing a need. Mr. Cowart recognized the need in his 1984 letter to provide locals housing. You'll see that language in his letter. That's not my, those aren't my words. Those are his words, where he's trying to say, look, I know the town wants this public benefit. I would like a benefit of my own, which is doubling the density on my property. If you give me the double density, I will restrict these units to long-term rental. And again, you're not seeing reference there to short-term accommodations, that I would prohibit short-term accommodations. You're hearing affirmative and strong statements that I will restrict this property to long-term rental. Your Honor, briefly, I would like to mention also a couple points about the intentions of the parties, because we know that they are appropriate for your determination. And I would draw your attention to Exhibit 2, which is some of the minutes from a 1984 meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission. And here's a quote on the town's intention. Another concern of McGowan's, who was the planning director at the time, was that the application for an increase in density was based on the intention of these units being used for long-term rental. She wanted some guarantee that these would actually be long-term rental. So case law says for restrictive covenants, find the intention of a party. Here we have a clear expression of the town's intent in 1984. And I do want to raise a rebuttal point to the suggestion by Mr. Coward that the Planning and Zoning Commission meetings are not relevant to your consideration. This was a two-step approval for a PUD process. Had to go to the Planning and Zoning Commission first for review and recommendation, and then on to Town Council. So it was absolutely imperative that it go through the Planning and Zoning process to get up to a review and recommendation to Town Council. But more importantly, those statements of intent, they're here in the written version and before you for your consideration. In conclusion, on behalf of the town of Telluride, I'd like to thank you for your time today. I'd like to ask respectfully that you affirm the decision of the district court in this matter. Such a determination would be consistent with the language of the plat, the history of the negotiations on this issue, applicable law on PUD restrictions, and the behavior or course of conduct of the parties on this matter. I believe my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Coleman, you're correct. You have just a little less than four minutes.
And I'll try to be quick. First, I want to get this affordable housing issue out of here. Affordable housing, the town will buy out the owner's rights, pay for them. And the town manager admitted this is not affordable housing. So all of these arguments about, well, this is part of the deal and it's going to provide affordable housing, that's not correct. We were never paid to give up owner occupancy. If you're paid to give it up, fine. The contract's clear and they do give it up. You have asked very pertinent questions about why is the town imposing an illogical restriction that could get around, any attorney could get around just by a simple lease. I don't know why either. But the practical aspect of it is, under current financing, owner-occupied can be financed. Non-owner-occupied, you're in a whole different league. So it's extremely detrimental for no logical reason other than, I'm not slandering town council, but the mentality of Telluride is fight. If someone wants something, fight. That's not a legitimate business or judicial reason. The occupancy, because these buildings are separate and will have separate ownership and has been confirmed of that, the reality of owner-occupied and financing is critical. There's a massive detriment being imposed here for no reason.
Mr. Coleman, am I correct in assuming that the Cowards intend that only one of the six units would be owner-occupied?
Cowards had always intended to occupy one themselves. But they also always knew that these were going to be separate ownerships. And if it's only one, you have now penalized two buildings and made them can't be financed. That was never their intent. Their intent was to provide six dwelling units for people. And the owner logically will occupy either zero or one of those. The remainder are available not as affordable housing, but as additional housing units for the community.
So could they sell, if they were able to occupy one of the units, could they sell the other five and have owners occupy those five units?
They can only sell three different tracts of land, each having two on it.
There would be three owners who could occupy
that? That is correct. Okay. Yes. The only other issues I thought I would want to mention very quickly, to clarify the affordable housing, I agree with the court's observation. It makes no sense to construe this in a way that's somewhat illogical and so easy to get around. Construe it the way the town and Cowards intended it in 85, not as the town has evolved. I mean, they're saying this is precursor. It's true, the town has evolved. The town is trying to impose much higher restrictions than are on this. So fall back to tradition, common law. If the restriction's not clear, it doesn't exist. It's clearly nowhere in here that says owners cannot occupy. The remaining issues will just rest on our brief. We are not waiving the expert testimony issue in any sense, but I think it's self-explanatory. And we would request that the court read this restriction as meaning we cannot have short-term accommodations. That protects the neighborhood, that protects the town's expectations, that is consistent with the Coward's expectations. And that's what the goal of contract construction is, protect expectations of the parties. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman, and thank you, Mr. Geiger, for your helpful arguments. This matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course.